Hi everyone. I was hoping you could help me. I have a side project that I've been working on, a side project podcast I call Buffalo Connections. I want to share with you the introduction and I want to share the first interview. And basically, what the podcast is all about, it's called Buffalo Connections, and it's all about interviewing the people that have made a significant impact in the resurgence of Buffalo, the resurgence of Buffalo that we've seen over the 3, 4 years really started decades ago. And so this podcast has given me an opportunity to interview the people that have made an impact in Buffalo's resurgence. And I call it Buffalo Connections because my last question in every interview is who in your connections, should I speak to next that played a role in this Buffalo resurgence? So it's been quite an enjoyable ride because every person that I speak to, I then go to the person that they requested to speak to next. And I have already spoken to people like Congressman Brian Higgins, to Mayor Tony Masiello, to probably people you've never heard of, but are making a significant impact in Buffalo today. And in the world today, where you turn on the news and you hear about Charlottesville and you hear about all these other cities where there's all of these issues going on, where people are not getting along, I think a podcast like this is more important today than ever. And I just want to share it with everybody. I want to show the world that Buffalo is the city of good neighbors and that we are all connected and that when we work together, we are far more successful. So if you could please listen to the introduction, the first interview, I'm looking for your opinion on this. I'm going to have this as a separate podcast, but for now, I just want you, my current listeners, to listen to this and give me your opinion. Is this something that you're interested in hearing more of? So I thank you for listening, and I look forward to hearing from you. Have a great day. For a long time, Buffalo, New York hasn't had much to boast about. Back in the early 1980s, Buffalo was in its third decade of population decline, having dropped from around 570,000 in 1950 to 350,000. Yet while the city rapidly emptied, the number of unemployed kept growing bigger. In 1982, unemployment hit 15.3% when Bethlehem Steel, one of Buffalo's top employers, hiring as many as 20,000 and formerly the world's largest steel manufacturing facility, closed down. But those weren't Buffalo's only problems. Decades of poor political leadership had also left Buffalo with a lack of good schools, race riots, increased crime, and crushing poverty. This was often reflected in the downtown core. Unless you were going to work, most people avoided the downtown area. By the early 1980s, the heart of the city was a ghost town, especially on the weekends. No one wanted to be there. Instead, many were trying to shift into the suburbs or move to a warmer city altogether as they searched for better job opportunities. To add insult to injury, Buffalo suffered one of its worst blizzards in 1977, making it a target for insults and jokes from people all over the world. So you might understand why the average Buffalonian wasn't exactly keen to talk about the city. There simply wasn't much worth talking about. That might be why the Buffalo Chamber of Commerce decided to improve the city's image by launching the Talking Proud campaign. I laughed the first time I saw the commercial. Even at 12 years old, I couldn't believe how ridiculous it was. The commercial began with a woman singing, "Buffalo's got the spirit, talking proud, listen up and you'll hear it, talking proud." As she sang, she walked down the streets of Buffalo with her chest puffed out in an exaggerated march step as her arms pumped up and down. As she passed other Buffalonians, they would stop what they were doing and follow her, singing in lockstep. The ads were terrible. Most cities typically create commercials to advertise their city and encourage tourists to visit. But Buffalo had fallen so low that the city was essentially advertising itself to its own residents just to convince them to stay. It was a desperate move, and instead of encouraging local pride, it merely became another opportunity for the rest of America to laugh at Buffalo. It didn't bother me, though. Like many Buffalonians, I was used to the jokes and the insults. I just ignored them and accepted life in Buffalo for what it was. And while the ads ran for a couple of years, they were unable to stop the relentless drop in Buffalo's population size, the closing of local businesses, or the steady rise of poverty and crime. One of the most notable business closures was of Trico Plant No. 1, the former home of the Trico Products Corporation, which operated from the 1920s until it closed in 1998. The building then remained dormant for years until it was purchased by the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus in 2007. An important turning point that opened my eyes and dramatically changed my views on Buffalo and how local residents were perceiving our city. By 2015, I was spending more time in the newly renovated building, where over 400,000 square feet was occupied by hundreds of startup and incubator businesses. I began working directly with those small business owners as a business consultant, and every time I would enter the building, I would feel a vibe that I had rarely felt in nearly 50 years. There was an energy, an excitement about the future, coming from countless millennials who were not only staying in Buffalo after graduation, but were also moving into the downtown core to live. Pockets of growth were sprouting up everywhere. Canal Side, the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, Larkinville, the Pagulas. We had gone decades without any real construction in Buffalo, and now, every which way I looked, the skyline was filled with construction cranes. Things are finally changing in Buffalo, and I've become excited about what I've been seeing and feeling that I had to know more. I want to know how this change happened, when it began, and most importantly, who has been making it happen. That's why I created Buffalo Connections, a podcast about Buffalo for Buffalo, where I interview the people who have played a role in the city's resurgence. They say anyone in the world is 6 degrees away from knowing anyone else. Well, in Buffalo, we are only 1 degree away. My final question to each interviewee asks them to offer a connection they have of a person who also played a role in the city's resurgence. Follow me as I follow the thread of connections that bring me to some of the most interesting people in Buffalo. People who are making and changing our city into a destination site that finally fills Buffalonians with pride. When I think of the stereotypical Buffalonian who grew up in the 1950s and 60s, I think of a hard-nosed individual from a blue-collar, lower-middle-class neighborhood who speaks with a flat-A Buffalo accent and refers to soda as pop. Someone who followed in their family's footsteps and took a job at the steel plant right out of high school. I think of a person who is not afraid to take chances. Someone who puts family and friends first. Someone who's got your back and willing to get into a fight when necessary. Someone who never quits. I think of someone who will go out of their way to help their neighbor. In fact, if we needed to pick a person to play the role of the stereotypical Buffalonian, Patrick Whalen would be a good choice. Patrick started his career at Bethlehem Steel, but as the economy worsened, Patrick was forced to make changes and started his own business. He became a serial entrepreneur, starting over 20 businesses. One of the most notable businesses was Fulfillment Systems International, FSI, a $20 million company with over 200 employees, which was successfully sold to UPS in 2000. Patrick currently sits on many boards of directors and is the director of the Niagara Global Tourism Institute and managing partner of Capstone Scientific, LLC, and executive vice president of the Canadian-American Border Trade Alliance. He's working towards accomplishing in Niagara Falls what he helped accomplish in Buffalo. Patrick served as the chief operations officer of the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus for nearly 8 years and played a pivotal role in filling over 400,000 square feet with startup and incubator businesses. Thanks to Patrick and his BNMC team, Treacle Plant Number 1 is now considered the hub for the Buffalo startup community, which is creating hundreds of new jobs for Buffalo. Please enjoy our interview with Mr. Patrick Whalen. Patrick, thanks again for joining me and being the first person in the interviews for Buffalo Connections. I think when I thought about who I should start with, you were one of the first people that I thought of. And obviously because you have so many connections, so many people know you. But also what I think is important when I think of how Buffalo is just turning around. I'm seeing it since I grew up. Back in the 70s and 80s, and I've seen the resurgence that's happening. I always thought about that one of the hubs, one of the things that I think of that's changed dramatically is that Buffalo now has a startup community. And when I think of the startup community, I think of the old Trico building, which is now completely full. And I think of you, and I think that you played a very important role in all of that. And I know there were a lot of people involved, but I think of you as creating this hub, because I know there were startups here before, and I know that community existed, but I didn't ever realize how big it was. And I think it's grown significantly because of the fact that there is now a place to go. And so I wanted to start there. I wanted to first understand how many square feet of space did you end up filling, you and your team?
Well, first, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be first.
Oh, it's my
really
a pleasure.
Honored to go first. The Trico building is about 128,000 square feet of gross space. Once you divide it up and put corridors and things in there, I'm not sure how much space are taken up by corridors, but it's a pretty big building. You know, especially for an incubator type place, it was very difficult to start that project. And one of the reasons you mentioned, and that is there really weren't a lot of startups here. On the medical campus, I can think of three or four at that time. In Buffalo, very difficult place to start companies. In New York City in general, it's hard to do. Buffalo, we didn't have an entrepreneurial culture, and we didn't have funding sources. There wasn't much in terms of coaching, so it was a difficult place to start. And then the second reason it was difficult is because the building was such a mess. We would take people in there and tell them we could build your space here, and they'd look at me like I was crazy. The place had little tiny slits for windows, and It was in very rough shape. The lobby was embarrassing. It was very difficult to convince people we could build that. So the medical campus, when I arrived, owned the building. And my office was across the street in a UB building, the Center of Excellence. And I could look out my window and see that building. And we would bring people on tours, and they would leave shaking their head or worse. And it was frustrating. And then what we decided to do was, let's just go do it. Let's just go build some space. We'll do the lobby, we'll do the elevator. We'll do what's called shell and core work. New windows, new ceiling, new HVAC. And we'll build out, at the time our staff, I think, was six. So we needed six offices and six cubicles. We built 11 offices, 12 offices and 11 cubicles. And we thought at the time it would be a good idea to have an incubator, but the University of Buffalo was in the incubator business and didn't want us to. The president at the time was not Satish, he was his predecessor, and he did not want us to compete with UB in the incubation business. So, and to be honest with you, at the time we didn't intend to be an incubator. We intended the building to be post-incubation space, a place where companies could go to when they graduated from an incubator and still get a little bit of support. So in order to do that, we decided we would build an office, a shared office environment. And so we built 12 offices, although we needed six. We built 11 cubicles, although we needed five. And we started to get people interested in renting a little office. And our first tenant actually was a startup. Mm. And funny story is, they're still in the building. It's a Vantage Home Telehealth. They've changed their name now, so I'm not sure what their name is today, but that was their name at the time. There were three people in the company. I showed them a corner office, this is the largest office we had. I said, how about this office? They said, this will be perfect. We'll be back in 2.5 months. I said, why 2.5 months? And they said, well, we don't have any money yet. We're going to raise some money and we're going to get some customers and we'll be able to afford it in 2.5 months. So the office was finished, it had furniture in it. I just said, well, take it. In 2.5 months, you can start paying rent. So we had our first tenant. And 2.5 months later, they started paying rent. I don't know how long it was, or 3 or 6 months later, they came to us and said, we got to leave. I said, why? I said, well, we didn't raise as much money as we thought. Sales aren't coming along the way we thought, so we can't pay the rent. Yeah. So we decided, I said, do you have a business plan? Yeah, we have a business plan. I said, well, can I see it? He said, yes. And almost unconsciously, we were entering the world of being an incubator because the tenant, I thought, needed help. Ultimately, what we ended up doing was rolling up 6 months of their rent into a convertible note, and they got to stay there rent-free. The rest is history. They now lease probably 7,000 or 8,000 square feet of space on a long-term lease on the first floor, and they have dozens of employees. So that was a real success story, and it was our first tenant.
Wow, that's great. And it probably helped that that was right at the beginning when you had the ability and perhaps a lot of the space to do something like that. More flexibility for sure.
Yeah. So then what happened is we filled that space up right away, the six offices and, you know, five or seven cubicles. So we decided to build more. We had built, you know, just put the carpet in and the ceilings and the lights, but we didn't build the actual walls in the cubicles. So we decided to do that, and as soon as we did that, we filled them up. So the office environment was going pretty well, but we still had an idea that, you know, we really bought this building to be post-incubation space for life science companies. And in order to do that, you know, we envisioned building lab space. But every time we bring a life science startup into the building, usually founded by a professor that knew nothing about construction or real estate or anything else, we would show them this raw space. It looked horrible. The old windshield wiper factory, with, you know, just gutted. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't get their head around how could you possibly build a lab here? And we can see that you build offices, but labs are a lot harder to build than offices. You can't possibly build labs in this place. So finally we decided, why don't we build four labs, and rent them just on spec? And that was probably the biggest gamble we took. Those four labs cost more to build than all the office space that we have built to date. Labs are very expensive to build. They're complicated. And at the time, we were about ready to build a parking garage. And in order to build a parking garage, we had to build tear down an old research building. And there were tenants in that old research building, and they needed a place to go. And one of them came, and he rented on a long-term basis the three labs, leaving us one. And then we were able to fill that right away. So that gamble paid off. But the big thing about that was, from then on, we could take potential customers into the space, say, look, we can build labs. Here they are. There's four, and they were beautiful labs. And that was the trick. We brought people in to look at those labs. And a guy named Bill Maggio was running a company called Imco Diagnostics at the time. And Bill came over, looked at the space, and he signed the first lease. He's still there. They're on the third floor. They have about 7,000 square feet of lab space for Imco Diagnostics. And from there, it got pretty easy, because then people could understand that we could do it.
Were you surprised initially when you started filling the space? It sounded to me like it almost happened quicker than you expected. Were you surprised by that?
Yes, I was. And the labs went, I mean, the office space went quicker than we expected. There was a pent-up demand, I think.
And why do you suppose that was?
Well, there wasn't a lot of people wanted. By then, the medical campus had some cachet. People wanted to be near it. They didn't really know what it was or why they wanted to be near it, but there were some people that wanted to be near it. People that were selling to Kaleida and Roswell, and they needed a little office space nearby. So it was pretty easy to fill the office space up initially. But the labs were much harder than we anticipated. Much, much, much harder. I don't know what we would have done if we didn't build those spec labs, and then we could show people that you could do it, because you can't underestimate how bad a condition that building was in. Mm. People really had a hard time envisioning that building could be redone, especially, you know, construction guys could understand it. Some real estate people could understand it. But if you didn't have a background in that, it was difficult to envision that that place could be anything again. Mm-hmm. So, and labs are difficult. In fact, labs, I wouldn't want to do it again. The labs need a lot of space above the ceiling for movement of air, because mm-hmm. they need to exit air out of the space, and then you need to refresh that air. And that building is floor to ceiling heights that are too short for that. So a lot of people said, why didn't you build Innovation Center 2 in the rest of the Trico building? That's the reason. It's just, you know, they're high ceilings for lofts, but they're very low ceilings for labs.
Where did the money initially come from to get started?
Well, my understanding is the medical campus owned the building because of a grant called Pioneers of Science. Came from the state of New York, and enabled my boss, Matt Enstis, to purchase at an auction that Trico building, both parts of it, the Innovation Center and the six-story part, the M. Weil building, which is now UB's Gateway building, and the parking lot across the street. So Matt went to an auction in Erie, Pennsylvania, bid on it, won it, and he used Pioneers of Science money, a grant called Pioneers of Science, to pay for the acquisition of those four properties. And then the state of New York had a grant program called Restore New York, mm-hmm. to be used to restore old buildings. And we got a $4.5 million Restore New York grant that enabled us to do the shell and core and the fourth floor, what is today the incubator. At the time was kind of envisioned to be a shared office environment, but that enabled us to get started. And I believe that enabled us to do the four labs as well. Then later on, the next problem was when lab companies came in, the labs were so expensive to build that startup companies couldn't afford to build that, pay for that build out. And we couldn't afford to pay for the build out. typically a landlord might build the space and then lease it back to the tenant, but the tenants were not creditworthy. So we went back to the state of New York and said, this isn't going to work. We need more money. And the state of New York came up with a program, a $5 million grant that we used to actually give the money to the tenant to pay down their leasehold improvements so that it held down their rent. The beauty of that program is that up until then, states and provinces in Canada and others, government agencies, would entice startup or encourage companies or startups by giving them money. And if the company went out of business, the money was gone. Mm. In this case, they gave us the money. We gave it for leasehold improvements. If the company went out of business, we still had the leasehold improvements and we could bring another company into the space. So it wasn't such a big risk on the part of New York State. As it turns out, I don't think we had anybody default.
Wow, that's incredible.
That is incredible. So the other thing that happened is the other part of the pent-up demand was we were starting to see these companies start. As soon as there were tools available for entrepreneurs started to say, hey, I can do this. I can start a company. And we put together an array of support. Once we admitted to ourselves that we were an incubator and not a shared office environment, we went out and got coaches and mentors and legal and accounting support. We got people in the community to come in and help entrepreneurs. And then we started to create our own ecosystem, basically, because there really wasn't one in Buffalo prior to the Innovation Center.
Yeah, I agree. There really wasn't one. And then all of a sudden, it just seemed like it came out of nowhere. Now, you were doing that how many years?
Well, it was a couple of years. I mean, it was probably 9 years ago that I started on the medical campus, and it was probably another 2 years before we actually moved into the building. And then probably another 2 years of just plugging along, getting base hits, not home runs, before anybody really noticed. Mm-hmm. We noticed. Sure. And we were quite proud of what we were doing, but I don't think the media or the community noticed too much. That took a little while.
So there was about 128,000 square feet. How many years did it take to fill that whole building?
Once we built those sample labs, we filled that building up in 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
So it went quickly.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Yeah. Because those weren't cheap spaces either.
No, it still isn't. We had to charge. We had to charge what we had to charge in order to pay the mortgage back. So the other thing I didn't mention is, in addition to getting the building basically for free through the Pioneers of Science and the $4.5 million Restore New York grant and a $5 million grant from the state of New York, we also went and got a big mortgage from KeyBank, and we had to pay that mortgage back, obviously, and make payments every month. So that required us to set the lease rates at a rate that made us the most expensive space in Buffalo. Mm. I think when we started there, we were 18 bucks a foot, and Key Tower was, you know, 15 or 14.
Wow.
So we were not cheap. And we sold location, 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 just like any good real estate developer would do. But we actually had a very good location. Not in the beginning. People thought, I remember when we hung a banner on the building before we moved in, it said we were going to change Buffalo's future here. It was big banner. It was 4 stories tall. Mm. And people thought we were crazy. There was just no traffic on that end of the campus. That end of the campus was dead. The MYO building was almost empty. The Trico building was empty. The parking lot across the street from there was not full ever. A couple dozen cars in it every day. Aurex was in and out of business. It was a rough neighborhood. And but if you go by there today, it's just hopping.
It really is.
Yeah.
There's been a considerable resurgence. And that's one of the things I like about just being in that building is that growing up
in the 80s, I'm living with the scars of watching the city continually decrease in population year after year, decade after decade. And when I would walk in that building, I would see a whole different vibe. I would feel a whole different vibe. There would be a whole different attitude. A bunch of kids and millennials and younger people who have never been affected by those scars. And you can see that something was different in there. And it was exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there is, you know, the other thing about the medical campus is, if you take a community like Rochester, they have a lot of the same assets we have in Buffalo. But through Tom Beecher and his and Mayor Masiello, their efforts to build this thing called the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus around the assets were really in the one neighborhood. It enabled us to centralize those things. And in a city the size of Buffalo, you need a focal point. You need that stuff to be in one spot so you can, you know, the sum of the parts is greater, you know, you just get more out of it. And in the entrepreneurial space, that's the same thing. It was so important, I think, that 43 North and Z80 came into that building, because that makes kind of Buffalo's entrepreneurial heartbeat is in that building, and everything's there. A place like Boston, there's 4 or 5 hearts, right?
Yeah.
Philadelphia, maybe. Obviously, Silicon Valley and San Jose. But in the city size of Buffalo, I think you need to concentrate. You need to really get critical mass. And it's difficult to do unless it's focused in one particular area. So in healthcare, it was focused there. In research, it was focused there. And then later in the entrepreneurial piece, it was focused there. I think those were important pieces of the puzzle.
What do you suppose is the reason for just the resurgence that we're seeing in Buffalo?
Well, I think there's a lot of people, especially a couple years ago, gave more credit than was due to the medical campus. The resurgence you see in Buffalo today is clearly broad. It's a wide, crosses a lot of different industries, and I think the medical campus played an important role because it was first. Mm-hmm. You know, Tom Beecher and the founding members of the medical campus and Mattis and others, they believed when no one else believed, and that provided a catalyst for the city. But the real change in the city of Buffalo and the real difference, I think, today is that Buffalonians believe. Everybody believes. So when everybody believes, then if you're thinking about where do I get my apartment, you're a millennial, you think, where do I want to live? I want to live in the city. If you're middle age and you say, I want to buy a house, where do you want to buy a house? I want to buy in the city. I'm going to open a dry cleaner. Where do I want to open the dry cleaner? I want to open in the city. It's the belief of the people that are in the community that's making the investment in the community. And you can't do that with government programs, or there's not enough money in the world to keep giving people money to populate a place. They have to want to populate it, and they have to believe before they want to. And that's the difference in Buffalo today. And I think Canal Side and what the Pagulas have done, along with the medical campus and a lot of other things, I think, are the reason that people believe. I think the governor and his commitment to Western New York also plays a part. The Buffalo Billion, we hear a lot about it, but the Buffalo Billion has not yet produced that many jobs. But it's changed the psyche of the people.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Right? So it's the tangible effort, as assets that are going to come out of the Buffalo Billion, we haven't seen yet other than construction jobs, right? There's been a lot of construction jobs around Solar City. AMRI has built 50,000 square feet of space on the medical campus, but I don't know if they've hired 20 people yet. So the long-term payoff is still down the road, but the change in the mindset of people that live in Western New York is what's making a difference every day with one house at a time, one apartment at a time, one small business at a time. People are not afraid to invest in the city of Buffalo anymore. In fact, they want to, right? There's a lot of investment in a lot of different places in the city of Buffalo, and that's because of the change in the mindset. So I'm in Niagara Falls now, where we are not yet there in our minds. Our folks in Niagara Falls don't believe yet, most of them, a lot of them. And I tell this story a lot. I said, 9 years ago, you could walk into a bar in Buffalo, order a beer, and say, Buffalo sucks. Yell it at the top of your lungs. And everybody would come up to you, slap you on the back, buy you another beer. You'd have a great time. If you did that today, nobody'd slap you on the back. He'd probably punch you in the lip. Because the mindset of the people that live in Buffalo is 180 degrees away from where it was 9 years ago. People in Buffalo believe. And that's what we hope to do here in Niagara Falls, is get people to believe. Now, how do they believe? You have to have something to believe in. So the medical campus was the first thing people could believe in Buffalo.
Interesting.
And then Pagula and the canal side came along. And you know, this is the kind of thing that it snowballs. It snowballs. And then look at the tax base. I mean, you don't hear a lot about this, but when you're pushing that ball up the hill, up the hill, up the hill, up the hill, and people are saying, you're never going to make it to the top, you're never going to make it to the top, why are you pushing that ball up the hill? A lot of us wonder, why are we pushing this ball up the hill? Once that ball hits the crest, it starts to roll, and it's fun watching that ball roll down the other side of the hill. Yeah. Things get a lot easier. The tax collections go up. All of a sudden, your local governments have more money to spend on other things. You know, everything gets a lot easier when that ball is running downhill. But boy, it's hard when you're pushing the ball uphill. And we're still pushing the ball uphill in Niagara Falls. Now, there's a lot more concrete stuff on the ground here. There's you know, hotels opening. There's been two open this year already. There's two opening this fall. There's one that just started under construction. There's another one that's going to start probably in the spring. So there is, you know, you can drive around downtown Niagara Falls and actually see it. But if people don't come downtown, right, they don't see it.
Right.
And they're conditioned to say, it's just, you know, it's a flash in the pan. It's not going to last. So it's going to take time. This is, you know, the medical campus. I started on the medical campus 9 years ago. Tom Beecher and Matt Ensis had already been at it for 4 or 5 years when I arrived. So it's the first thing you do is get everybody on the same page. The leaders of Kaleida, Roswell, and UB, and Houtman Woodward, and the other institutions, they had to get on board and get comfortable with each other and trust each other in order for them to start to collaborate. So communications first, then collaboration, then co-location of assets, and then job creation. Mm-hmm. So those four C's happened in Buffalo, but it takes time.
Why, now you've owned 20 different businesses, and you have had success with many of them in selling them, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. But I'm just curious, why did you decide to do this, to become the COO of the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, instead of just staying entrepreneur and, you know, keep doing your thing?
Well, I think I've always had, I became an entrepreneur, I think, because I wanted to make a difference in the community. So this was in the mid-1980s. My kids were little. I was driving with them from my house in East Aurora to my parents' house in Amherst, and we were driving over some railroad tracks of what used to be a railroad yard, the Bison Yard. And my kids started to fight. And I thought, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I got another 20 minutes in the car. If these kids start fighting, I'm alone with them. I gotta keep them occupied. So kids love trains. So I said, kids, hey, I used to drive a truck and I used to deliver to the railroad yard down there. And they looked and said, what railroad yard? Because by that time it was all just weeds growing up around the rails. And I said, well, there used to be a railroad yard there. And they said, What happened to it? And you know the way three-year-old and five-year-old kids just ask question after question after question. So they started the questions. What happened to the railroads? Well, we don't need the railroad anymore because the businesses that need railroads are gone. What happened to the businesses? Well, they went out of business. What happened to the people that worked at the businesses? Well, they've had to leave. And that's why when we want to see your aunts and uncles, we usually have to get on an airplane and go visit your aunts and uncles. And my daughter said, where are we going to work? And it was really at that instant that I decided, you know, enough talking about what we're going to do about the situation we're in the mid-1980s when the steel plants were closing, Westinghouse was closing, J.H. Williams was closing, all the support industries that supported all those industries were closing. It was a pretty dim time, and I thought, unless somebody stops talking about what we're going to do about this and starts doing something about what we're going to do about keeping our kids here, we're not going to keep our kids here. So I decided then that I would start a business. I could think of only two things that we had as real assets that were going to never go away. One's Canada, and one is water. And I couldn't think of anything to do with water, so I started a cross-border logistics business. I was working for UPS at the time, so it was easy for me to understand logistics. And I started that business, so a lot of people start businesses because they got an idea they think is better than anybody else's and they want to see their idea flourish. Other people start businesses because they want to be rich. They want to make a lot of money. I had a different motivation. I wanted to start a business so I could employ people and kind of do my part to reverse the trend or the track that Buffalo was on. So fast forward 15 years to when I sold that business. It was disappointing, actually, that a lot of the jobs that we had created went elsewhere when UPS ironically bought the business from me. And they transferred sales to Toronto, they transferred accounting to Montreal, and engineering went to Louisville, Kentucky, and most of the good jobs were gone. UPS still operates warehouses here and has trucks that go back and forth, but a lot of the really good jobs went elsewhere. So that was disappointing. And then I worked there for 2 years for UPS, rolled out our model across the U.S.-Canada border and kind of helped UPS roll out that model globally. And then I realized after 2 years that UPS had changed in the 15 years I was gone, and I didn't like it as much as the UPS I had left 15 years earlier. And probably I had changed a lot. I had become a lot more entrepreneurial in my thought process. And anyways, it wasn't a good place for me, and I rather abruptly quit after 2 years. And I really, one of the lessons I learned is you don't retire from something, you retire to something. And I didn't have something to retire to. I was still pretty young, and I started to ski. And I thought I'd go skiing for a while, look for a business to buy. And before I knew it, I had been skiing for 5 years. And I met my wife, and she basically made me realize, I don't think she even knows this, but she really made me realize that I was kind of wasting my time and that I ought to do something to get back onto the mission I was on when I quit my job at UPS 20 years earlier, and that I ought to do something creative to help the community and get it back on track. So the opportunity to work for the medical campus came up, and I jumped at that. I left 9 months ago, you know, mostly because I worked myself out of a job. The building innovation center's full. We have two other buildings that are incubators. They're full. I was responsible for parking, and we got a guy named Bill Smith that knows more about parking than I'm ever going to know. He doesn't need me. A lot of the operational things we have staff that can do. They didn't need me anymore. So this opportunity in Niagara Falls came up around the same time. And I see a lot of parallels in Niagara Falls to Buffalo. I see a lot of parallels in our organization to the medical campus. The board is structured the same way. We have a committee structure the way the medical campus has a committee structure. And I think a lot of the pieces are here for success in Niagara Falls, just as they were 9 years ago in Buffalo. But it took Tom Beecher and Mayor Masiello to see those pieces and actually put them together. I think my predecessor and Chris Shefflin with the state of New York actually have seen the pieces here, and they put the organized a structure here that allows us to visualize the pieces. In both cases, I think on the medical campus and here, once you have a vision, somebody has to operationalize the vision, and that's what I hope to do here.
So you basically got bored. Like a serial entrepreneur, you basically got bored with the regular. You filled the building. You essentially achieved what you wanted to achieve, and now you want to start over again.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity on the medical campus still, obviously. There's a long way to go. But you're right in that the medical campus today, as we sit here, I've been gone 9 months. They're probably still 3 years away from having another building to fill. That means I would have been 40-some months mm-hmm. of maintaining. I'm not good at maintenance. I'm a builder. I'm a grower. So I wanted to go somewhere where I could grow again, not just maintain what we already built.
Who are some of the people that inspired you or unsung heroes that kind of helped you get to where you are?
Well, my first father-in-law, a guy named Gus Anderson, was probably the biggest influence on my life. And I learned a lot of lessons from him, and he always believed in me. I worked for a guy at UPS. His name was Bob Henry. Tremendous operational guy. He was a district manager when I met him, which is a fairly high position within the UPS management team. But he was brilliant, and I learned a lot from him. One of the things I learned from Bob Henry was nobody gets up in the morning and says, I'm going to do a lousy job. Everybody gets up in the morning and wants to do a good job. And at the time, we had all these problems with UPS drivers who were Teamsters, and everybody, you know, the rest of the management team all thought, these guys get up in the morning and want to do a bad job. And Bob Henry used to say, nobody gets up in the morning and wants to do a bad job. They're doing a bad job because we're not giving them the tools. That was a really important lesson, I think, yeah. Especially in the place I was in my maturation process. When I started FSI, the key guy was a guy named Bill Ur. He owns Ur Supply, still around. I had the idea for a business. I happened to meet him. I told him what my idea was. He said, why don't you do it here in the Wurlitzer building? I said, well, I'll probably never do it. He said, why not? I said, because I got a wife and two little kids. I got a really good job at UPS. They're fast-tracking me through this management process, and and I don't have any money. And he leaned across the table. He says, I'll give you a 400 square foot room here in the Wurlitzer building for free.
Nice.
As soon as you start making money, you can start paying rent. And that was the day I started FSI. This was right after my kids had said, where are we going to work when we grow up? And I was thinking about what are we going to do with Canada, what are we going to do with water, and I had this idea for cross-border logistics. He gave me the space to do it in, and that's why I did it there. So, and over the years, he was my landlord for the whole time I owned that business. His son-in-law, Tom Austin, runs that building for him. But Bill was a guy that I could always go to and have a conversation with. He was a great mentor. A lot of mentors on the medical campus, not the least of which was Beecher, who used to say, if we run into an obstacle, let's not try to, bash our way through the obstacle. Let's just go around it. Just leave it. There's plenty to do. Let's just go do something else. Mm-hmm. And that's been a very good lesson. That was a good lesson there. It's a good lesson here. There are a lot of people that either purposely or by mistake actually get in the way And the best thing you can do is ignore them and just go, you know, go work on some other aspect of your plan. So that's been a good lesson. So I've had a lot of good mentors on the financial aspect of the medical campus. An unsung hero is a guy named Tony Martino, CPA, vice chair of the board. You never hear about this guy ever. But he was a great, still is a great coach and a great mentor. It's a long story, but we had to borrow $36 million to build a parking garage on the medical campus. And at the time, we had assets of maybe $16 million. And I said, how are we going to borrow $34 million when we only have $16 million of assets? And Tony said, let's do an RFP. We'll send it out to all the banks. We'll see what happens. And we actually had a bidding war between the banks. Wow. They wanted to lend us $34 million bucks.
Wow.
But Tony never lost faith. He believed, and it worked. So there's been a lot of really good mentors. I've been fortunate to have a lot of mentors.
The Buffalo, where do you see Buffalo 5 years from now or 10 years from now? What do you think you're going to see? With the resurgence that we've seen so far?
Well, I hope that we're going to see some of these startups mature and stay here, right? It's going to be difficult. First of all, it's very difficult to grow a business from startup to a mature company. You know, it's hard to do. When you get to a certain point, what is your exit strategy? A lot of times the exit strategy is to sell to someone else, and that someone else may take the business elsewhere. So this has been a big problem in Buffalo. We've seen a lot of companies start here and grow, get bought. But my company is a really good example, right? So I grew a company at a couple hundred employees, and I don't know how many employees that company has today. It's UPS Supply Chain Solutions is the name of it today, and you can probably go to their warehouse and I bet you they don't have 80 people. Mm-hmm. And those 80 jobs are good jobs, but they're not the best jobs that we created. The IT department's not here, the finance department's not here, there's no CEO here, the engineering department's not here. So that's a really good example of what happens to a company as it grows and it gets sold. So, you know, the great successes we have in Buffalo would be Moog, Rich Products, M&T Bank. You know, these are companies that didn't sell, are still headquartered here. And we need to have that happen on a pretty regular basis in order to see this, the trend we're on, continue. I like to say that we don't want to admit it in Buffalo, but we're faking it till we make it, right? Because we all feel good. There's believers now, but we're kidding ourselves if we think we've made it. We need to see a lot more of what we've seen in the past few years. And we need, in terms of startups, I think it's a very difficult thing. It's very difficult to get another Geico, right? How do you convince companies to come to Western New York? There's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to come to Western New York. Whether they're true or not true is perception. But perception becomes reality when you travel around the United States. People just don't want to be here. That's probably unfortunate for them. But because it's not true, perceptions are false. But it's unfortunate for us because they're not coming here. So we need to grow our own. And when we grow our own, somehow, some way, we've got to figure out how to keep them here. And that's not easy.
What's the difficult part of keeping a startup here?
Well, I think I use my own company as an example again. There were a lot of reasons. Now, this is a good example. There were a lot of reasons for UPS to keep their cross-border business headquartered in Buffalo, but they didn't. And you got to think about why that is. Why did basically the customer service department move to Aiken, South Carolina. Why is that? And why is the sales department in Toronto? And why is the accounting department in Montreal? And why is the engineering department in Louisville? There are reasons for that. And the tax environment, the business regulation environment in New York State are certainly detriments. So we need to fix these things to keep companies here. I think Moog is here despite that. So maybe what we need to do is sit down with Moog and say, well, how come you guys don't leave? But they did. The other part about it is they were able to raise enough capital. You know, they went public and they raised capital and they were able to stay here. So if capital becomes available locally and they invest in our local companies, then there's less stress on the company, less reason for them to leave. But if the investors that invest in a Buffalo startup are from, pick a city, Chicago, those Chicago investors may say, we'd like you to move closer to us so we can keep an eye on you, right? And so a lot of it's capital. We need to generate more capital, patient capital that'll stick with these startups as they mature.
What about
we saw this with, by the way, sorry to interrupt, but Athenex, formerly known as Kinex, have got a lot of investors from China. And the Chinese investors are saying, why is this company in Buffalo? We'd like it in California. If it needs to stay in the United States, bring it to California so it's closer to us. It's at least 3,000 miles in 3 hours closer to us. But there's enough, I think, I don't know the inside story of Athenex, but I think there are enough local investors that said, no, whoa, wait a minute, we don't want you to leave. And the founder, David Angauer, whose technology they're commercializing, is a Buffalo guy. He's a UB professor, and he doesn't want to leave. So we need to see that happen more often in order for some of these companies to grow.
Is the labor a part of it, the knowledge, the specialty labor? Is that sometimes the problem?
I don't think so. I think in the old days it was, but I think, you know, we have a lot of universities here, and the University of Buffalo is generating an awful lot of talent. This is a small community, though, relative to some of the places we're competing with. We're competing with places like Boston and Philadelphia and Phoenix that are much larger. So they just have more stuff, you know. If it's we just went through a situation on the medical campus before I left of an eye research company. The best eye researchers in the world are in Dallas-Fort Worth. They have 10 eye researchers in their institute. I was in Japan talking to the company, trying to get them to move to Buffalo. The guy that runs the company says to Jim Reynolds, who runs the Ross Eye Institute, how many eye researchers do you have? Jim very proudly, and he should be proud, said 5. Well, the best guys in the world are in Dallas-Fort Worth, and they got 10. So where do you think we're going? And I don't think it's any knock on the Ross Eye Institute. Dallas is just more than twice the size of Buffalo, so of course they're going to have more eye researchers. So we need to figure out how to do that. I was late for this interview because I was just at Brock University, and we're working real hard to form an alliance between Brock University, McMaster University, and Hamilton. Brock is in St. Catharines, and the University of Buffalo, because there's 2.5 million people on the other side of the border. Mm-hmm. If that border wasn't there, we would consider this to be a community of 3.5 million people, not a community of 1 million people in Western New York. Mm-hmm. So we need to somehow figure out how to attach those 2.5 million people to our community and make this a 3.5 million person community where we have, McMaster ironically has 5 eye researchers.
So how do you do that?
Well, we're starting something called the Binational Research and Innovation Corridor. It won't be exclusive to life sciences, but it'll be focused on life science. Brock has 19,000 students in an allied health program where they train health professionals. McMaster has a med school. They have 28,000 students. University of Buffalo has a med school. They have 28,000 students. Collectively, those three universities are a force. Mm. And And then there's 2.5 million people on the Canadian side, 1 million on the U.S. side. Collectively, there's 3.5 million people in this community, if we consider it one community. And we certainly would. It's not no big geographic footprint than Dallas-Fort Worth is. Mm-hmm. But we need to consider this to be one community. On the research side, it's easier to do. Researchers have it's in their DNA to collaborate. So it's a lot easier to get researchers at the University of Buffalo to collaborate with researchers at McMaster University than it would be, for example, my past life at logistics companies. You know, we don't want to play nice, right? We compete with each other. Researchers don't do that. So we're trying to establish a binational community here focused on research. So the next time somebody like me goes to Japan and says, why don't you come to Buffalo? And the guy doesn't say, because you only have 10 researchers, I researchers. No, we have 10, he said we only have 5, I'm not coming. Well, now with McMaster's 5 and our 5, we got 10. We have the same number as Dallas-Fort Worth. So we're back, you know, actually we have called this guy and told him that and said, you know, we have as many as Dallas-Fort Worth is. We don't have the best, we don't have the rock star, admittedly. But we have other strengths. This guy happens to have a technology that's based on stem cells. Well, we're really good at stem cells here. We're probably better at stem cell technology in Western New York and at McMaster than they are at Dallas-Fort Worth. So we don't have the rock star eye doctor, but we got stem cell rock stars, and we got eye researchers. So maybe we got a chance to bring this company here that's still in a research stage, but they're going to create jobs, right?
Yeah.
So that's a way that we can grow this community by leveraging the other side of the border.
Now in Buffalo, we talked about the hub and that kind of help, that centralized hub. Is there a centralized hub that you're focusing on in Niagara Falls?
For the tourism business? No, I think yes and no. I think Niagara Falls has got a relatively small footprint, what we call downtown Niagara Falls. That's where the tourist attractions are, centered on the state park. Mm-hmm. The hotels are nearby that state park and the conference center. This is not far flung. We do have attractions on the side of the border that go all the way up to Old Fort Niagara. And one of the things that we're really focused on within our organization for winter is to try to get people to stay another night in Niagara Falls, New York, in the winter. How do you do that? Well, we got an awful lot of attractions in Buffalo that are winter appropriate. We have the Albright Knox, the Darwin Martin House, the zoo is even winter appropriate. If they like to skate, they can go to Canal Side. There's the Pierce Arrow Museum, there's the Teddy Roosevelt site. There's a lot of things to do in Buffalo in the winter that are winter appropriate. And we have a train station opening here in Niagara Falls downtown with 3 trains a day that run to Buffalo. So what we hope to do is get people to stay, some people to stay, another night this winter by offering them free tickets to the Albright Knox, as an example. If you stay another night with us, I'll get you 2 free tickets to the Albright Knox. Put them on a train, get them to Buffalo, the Albright will pick them up at the Exchange 3 station, bring them to the Albright Knox, and bring them back to the train station. So we need to figure out how to get people to stay here another night in the winter in order to improve the environment here. And then later, we will build, I hope the state or someone will build winter attractions in Niagara Falls. So there's less reason they have to go to Buffalo. In the summer, this is not an issue. In the summer right now, you can't get a room in Niagara Falls, New York. In fact, the occupancy rates in the Buffalo hotels on weekends in the summer are higher than the national average, way higher than the national average for business, central business districts. The reason for that is because you can't get a room in Niagara Falls, New York. Mm. So people are staying in Buffalo in the what would normally be business hotels on weekends and driving to see Niagara Falls. So we can't get any more people at Niagara Falls in the summer. But it drops off so dramatically in the winter that enables that makes a lot of the jobs basically summer jobs, not careers. And it makes financing attractions. We want to build something for winter, but how do you finance it? How do you finance more hotel rooms if this huge drop-off in seasonality? We've got to fix the seasonality. It's always going to be a seasonal market, but we need the drop-off to be less severe so that the financing becomes much more doable and the workforce becomes much more stable, because you employ more people year-round and have less employment that's considered summer jobs.
How do you make Niagara Falls people feel the belief that you're starting to see in Buffalo?
Well, I'm a firm believer in base hits, not swinging for the fences. So I think in Buffalo, 9 years ago, we made a concerted effort on the medical campus to say, let's not try to hit home runs here. Let's just get base hits. Let's get one company in the incubator, even if we got to give them 2.5 months free rent. Let's get one company here. That's a little win. That's a little base hit. At the time, you'll remember that Buffalo was swinging for the fences with things like Bass Pro, and everybody had a silver bullet solution to the Buffalo problem. And I don't believe there are silver bullet solutions. I think you got to get base hits. So this winter is an example. Again, we'll try to get 6% more people to stay here next winter by getting them to go to Buffalo. That's a base hit. That's certainly not a home run. And I think if you keep getting base hits, you keep making contact with that ball, keep getting base hits, eventually the runners round the bases and they score a run. It's not flashy. It's not a home run. But over time, it works, and people, it's going to be a gradual thing. It actually was gradual in Buffalo. It seems like it happened overnight, but it really took a long time. These things took a long time to get as messed up as the economy is in Western New York. It's going to take a long time, hopefully not as long, but it's going to take a long time to fix it. Right. But I really believe, firm believer in base hits. So a lot of people lament the fact there's 4,000 hotel rooms in Niagara Falls, New York. They're all full all summer long. But in the winter, everybody will tell you right away, there's 3,000 empty rooms every night in Niagara Falls. And I say, yeah, that means there's 1,000 rooms that are full. Mm-hmm. If we can get 6% of those people to stay another night, that's a base hit. We got 6% increase in the winter occupancy rate. If you do that 2 or 3 years in a row, and we have better hotel rooms coming on, so now we can actually book more conferences in Niagara Falls. You know, in 2 or 3 years, you can actually see a market improvement in the occupancy rates in Niagara Falls. Now you can talk to lenders about, hey, this is what we want to build. We need financing, and it's actually possible to get it financed. But right now, the occupancy rates are so low in the winter here that it's very difficult to finance a project, especially a tourism project or a restaurant or a hotel. We need to, you know, I think it's, you know, it's my own belief that it's basic blocking and tackling. You know, we got to raise the occupancy rate in the winter so that we can convince the lenders that this is a worthy investment. And we have to raise the occupancy rate in the winter so that we create more careers in hospitality that are going to be filled by the people that live in Niagara Falls, that are today the people that don't believe. Well, if they get jobs here that are full-time jobs that go year-round, they'll start to believe. They'll see that this actually works, and young people can actually stay here and get a career. That's what's happened in Buffalo. Young people now believe they can get a job in Buffalo, so they're not leaving.
Right.
Yes. The demographics of Buffalo, it's not just that the population is stabilized. This population is stabilized is awesome news, because guess who's making up for the old people that are leaving or dying? It's young people that are, the demographic shift in Buffalo is the really good news. Because young people now don't leave. They believe they can get a job in Buffalo, so they don't leave. If we can start to do that in Niagara Falls, and the people that we start, and the other misnomer is tourism jobs are lousy jobs. I would argue that a lot of them are, but a lot of them in any business that are entry-level jobs are lousy jobs, right? It's a pathway in, It sort of beats not having a job. And as you get in and you do a good job, you can get promoted. And there's less resistance, actually, to promotion within tourism than there is in probably most other businesses. You know, you're not going to get a job at an entry-level job on the medical campus and become a doctor, right?
Right.
But you can become an entry-level job, get an entry-level job in tourism in Niagara Falls and become a restaurant manager or a hotel manager. This is possible to do.
It is exciting to see that the kids today, you don't feel like they have to leave after they graduate to find a job. And I've noticed that change, and it is exciting to see that. One of the characteristics that I think have helped you become very successful, would help you in Buffalo become successful, is that even though you're an entrepreneur and that you have that serial entrepreneurship about you, you're very good at communicating and working with state government people, things like that, and finding a way to explain the logic to them so that then you can get them to make changes. Do you feel like you're getting the people in Niagara Falls, the state, the government, to listen in that same way?
Yes, I think that I'm not sure I'm doing it, but I think there's a different attitude in Niagara Falls than there was a few years ago. I have a lot of experience in Niagara County. My business was in Niagara County. Myself and two other guys, before I took the job on the medical campus, had a plan to build an air cargo facility at the Niagara Falls Airport. We did spend a lot of time and money trying to figure out how to do that. A lot of that time was spent with government and economic development people. I see a different attitude here entirely. I think Mayor Dyster has the right attitude. I think that before it was just, you're going to do it our way. This is the way we do things in Niagara Falls and Niagara County, and we don't care how you do it elsewhere, especially if you're from Buffalo. I don't see that as much anymore. I think they're really much more progressive and much more anxious to realize, I think a lot of people here have realized, holy cow, man, we got to get going. And there's been a lot of, people in Niagara Falls are very sensitive to outside criticism, and well, they should be. But a lot of it is warranted. Mm-hmm. This has been a difficult place to do business.
You've got Niagara Falls in walking distance.
Yeah.
You feel like you can do something with that, right? You would think.
And I think now, again, Chris Shefflin is a guy that has had a vision in Niagara Falls. I'm basically here to operationalize a lot of things that he and Mayor Dyster have envisioned, and others. Mark Thomas is on our board. He's with the state parks. The guy that runs the Maid of the Mist is on a board. The guy that runs the Sheraton Hotels, Frank Strangio, owns two hotels. We've got a strong board. And I think Eddie brought that board together, and they are talking now. So that makes a big difference. If there's no communication, there's not going to be any change. There was very little communication 15 years ago in Buffalo between Collider, Roswell, and UB. It wasn't until Masiello said to Beecher, "Look, this is too important. We've got to figure this out." And Tom actually said, "Okay," and did something about it, and fostered that communication. I don't think though any of the people running, Candace Johnson or Satish or Jody LeMayo or the other people that are involved in the medical campus or seven other institutions, I don't think they could even imagine not being part of the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus today. But 15 years ago, when Tom started to talk about it, I think they had a very hard time imagining being part of it. Mm. It's all about communication. It's all about collaboration. If you don't communicate, you're certainly not going to collaborate. And if in this day and age, even for private sector businesses, if you don't collaborate, you think the iPhone would have ever? There was a great TED talk on the development of the iPhone and how many different technologies are in the thing. Mm. We all give Steve Jobs credit, and he deserves a lot of credit. But really what he did was he brought all that technology together to collaborate on the development of the iPhone. It's, no one is going to do something on their own anymore. Those days are over. In government, in industry, in academia, everybody has to communicate, and we can get a lot farther faster by communicating one and collaborating number two. And I think we're seeing that begin. And I think you actually are seeing the fruits of that in Niagara Falls. It'll be a while before you see anything like you've seen in Buffalo. But
well, you certainly help in that respect. So I'm expecting to see you hitting singles and doubles very shortly, I'm sure. Well, as you know, this is Buffalo Connections, and which means that we're practically only one degree away from knowing everybody. And so my last question to you, Pat, is who in your connections do you think would be the next person that we should talk to regarding Buffalo Connections and the resurgence and somebody who's made an impact?
Well, I can't imagine anybody that's made more impact than Tom Beecher. People a lot of times used to say to me, do you think you're really going to change Buffalo through the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus? And the answer was no. I don't think we're going to change Buffalo through the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus, but it can be the catalyst. It can be the start. It can be the thing that makes people realize what Buffalo can be. And Tom is the guy that made that happen. Today, for me, I actually call him up from time to time and say, what do you think I ought to do about this? Because we're doing the same thing. We're following the same playbook here in Niagara Falls that Tom used in Buffalo, on the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus. So I really believe it all started with Tom Beecher and Tony Masiello. And I can't imagine, I'm sure Buffalo would be along its way on its resurgence, but I don't think it'd be anywhere near as far along as it is today without Tom Beecher's vision.
Excellent.
So he'd be the guy I'd talk to next.
Excellent. Then it's Tom Beecher that we'll be talking to next. Again, Patrick Whalen, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. I love the stories, and I look forward to probably doing this again sometime in the future, and we can just see how much progress there is with Niagara Falls as well.
Super.
Excellent.
Great. Thanks,
Tony. Thanks, man. Take care.